Hello, Outriders. We're packed to the rafters this week with a cast of too many people to name in the introduction, so best we get straight on with it. Andrew Back has been to a meeting of the Open Source Hardware User Group. This is a collection of people with shared interest in open source hardware, and they meet around once a month in central London. As the name suggests, open source hardware is about taking the same principles for the development of open source software, like Firefox or Linux, and applying them to the development of hardware, so physical objects. Interestingly, this can be anything from furniture to a car. However, this is more typically electronics. Open source hardware might seem like a relatively recent phenomenon, but its core principles were central to past ambitious projects like the BBC's Computer Literacy and Domesday projects. Andrew caught up with the people who were speaking at the event about learning from past examples and working today for an open source future. First up, David Allen, who was the editor of the BBC Computer Literacy Project, and he describes how his work came about.
Funnily enough, it was a Horizon programme called Now the Chips Are Down. Horizon did a programme about the failure of the British government to take microelectronics seriously. And the Department of Trade and Industry officials were also very concerned about this. And people were saying that microelectronics was going to have a very profound effect on employment and on education and on society generally. Now, the BBC Computer was just part of it. I mean, there were over 100 television programmes and radio programmes. There was a whole range of support within the education world. The reason we had the computer was that we wanted something that had the right kind of language, that did a whole range of things that computers on the market in those days didn't really do. And because it was the BBC, we wanted to be able to run teletext. And we tried to see if all the manufacturers in the country could come up with, if you like, with some sort of agreement on a common language to use. Because in those days, you had to write programs, really, to get the thing to do anything.
Sure.
So we got them all together, and we tried to persuade them, and they wouldn't. Basically, they said, well, somebody else has got to pay for it, and anyway, we've got our own form of BASIC. You know, it was BASIC was the language that people used in those days. So we had a structured BASIC, which we called Adopted BASIC for Computers, ABC.
Okay.
And we got a group of manufacturers who submitted their what they had in the pipeline to us, and we said, could you implement this form of language? We then looked at the various submissions, and there was a range of companies that came up, one of which happened to be Acorn Computers, and they came up with something that we thought was the most promising. The BBC Micro was adopted, and it was the computer that was the main computer that went into particularly primary schools. 85% of primary schools used the BBC Micro.
My name's Andy Finney, and I was one of the founders of the Domesday Project and went on to be a producer on the main video disc.
Could you tell us the background to the Domesday Project and how it came to be?
I've been working in BBC Video for a while, particularly interested in producing video discs, which were on sale to the general public at the time. A television producer named Peter Armstrong appeared in my office with an idea for an interactive documentary. He knew that also I'd been experimenting with linking up a BBC Micro to a video disc player, and the idea behind that is that you could control the video disc player to go to anywhere within one side of the disc quite quickly. And interactive video was starting to become used in education and training, particularly in the United States. Hadn't made much of an inroad in Europe at that point, but mostly when people were trying it over here, they were using the BBC Micro because it was a very television-friendly microcomputer. Peter came into my office, said that he had an idea to do an interactive documentary so that people could choose their path through the material within the television documentary. I explained to him that actually you only had about 36 minutes worth of material to play with on one side of an interactive disc, but you could look at that another way, and that was 54,000 individually addressable frames. Okay, he said, he went away and came back the next day, and my memory is that pretty well at that point he had the Domesday Project fully formed in his mind. He worked out what a plethora 54,000 frames could be, and we looked into how we would make that work from a practical point of view. I remember at one point we ended up in an office just off the side of Queen's Park Rangers football ground, and the Domesday Project was on its way. That was 1984.
From what I understand, there's a fairly radical approach taken to the media production.
The project was a collaboration between the BBC, who did the audiovisual production and gathered the data, from a very large number of schools and other people, up to 1 million people, who we asked to produce photographs and text. The IT company Logica, who wrote the software to control the system, and Philips, who produced the video disc player. The central process for organising, getting all this information out of the schools was handled by the BBC. By that time, we were in an office in West London. The process involved taking 4x3 kilometre blocks of the country based on Ordnance Survey maps and offering them up to schools and other people to take over, if you like, the surveying of that particular block, take 4 photographs, from which we choose 3, and to write 20 CFAX-sized pages of text about that area. It was probably not a success from a marketing point of view, and that was primarily because when we started the project, we had the idea that the hardware would cost of the order of £1,000 or so for a school or a library to buy. But by the time the project had finished, the hardware cost had rocketed to over £5,000. And to put that in context, as I believe people do when they talk about this, the Doomsday system cost about the same as a Ford Escort car by the time it was produced. So that was obviously never going to be one in every primary school, which was a shame.
My name is Daniel Soltis, and I am a physical interaction designer, whatever that means.
You use Arduino in a learning context. Mm-hmm. So for those who are not familiar with Arduino, if you could briefly explain what it is.
Okay, so Arduino is a piece of kit. So it's a small board that lets you interface things in the world, so physical devices in the world, through the board into your computer, so that you can sort of sense what's going on out in the world and connect it to a program, or write some sort of program and have something happen on your computer or online and change something like light or movement in the world.
Okay, so this is a small, low-cost computer, then. It's quite an accessible platform.
Yes, yes.
Right to say. Could you tell us a little bit more about the work that you do with this technology, then?
I sort of probably work on two main realms, and one is in doing interaction design, so I use it to build projects that connect real-world interactions into computers, so sort of sculptures that might respond to something going on online, or sensor systems that might read what you're doing and how you're moving through a room and affect some sort of display or something. So that's sort of one side of what I do is design with that. And then the other side I do is I teach about Arduino. So I work with people to learn how to use it and sort of get up and running quite quickly to start prototyping their own ideas, and sort of more generally work teaching around innovation and how you can use the idea of building things quickly and doing hands-on building as a way of thinking and coming up with new ideas.
Why would you say that the Arduino technology is particularly well-suited to that type of task and to supporting learning?
So one of the things that's well-suited about it is that there is a lot of documentation about it, and there's a good community around it. So even if you're relatively new to it, there's a good chance that you'll be able to connect with other people or even just look online and see somebody who's done what you've thought about. So there's not much formal curriculum about Arduino, but there's a lot of informal curriculum, and there's a whole sort of, because it's an open source project, which has led to this whole community of sharing. So a lot of times people will make something and share about what they do. So it's quite easy to be a beginner and sort of get invested and have a lot of people out there who are sort of working on your level to figure out how to do things.
Whilst the relatively recent advent of open source software and now hardware have brought about exciting new possibilities for learning technology, there is also a great deal that can be learnt from much earlier endeavours. Only if we look to past successes and failures can we ensure that we build on these and strive to avoid pitfalls.
Thanks to Andrew Bagg there, learning about learning, past and future. Now, there's something satisfying about making something for yourself, whether that's creating your own programmes and applications or electronics, or even growing your own food. Now, Mark Spofforth and his team have managed to combine both of these things with LoveFresh application, which might mean that we can learn more about what we put in our mouths.
My wife and I have really enjoyed going around camping in the UK, and the first thing that we do when we get to Cornwall or whatever is try and find out where the great local farm shops are or where the nice restaurants are that take an interest in supporting the local produce. It's never been easy. It's always been really difficult to do. It takes a load of effort. The main pain point comes out of that with LoveFresh and then was amplified when I moved to the countryside after 20 years in London and really thought, well, here we go. You know, now I'm going to connect with local food producers. It's going to be like going to the old-fashioned butchers when I was a child. But no, it was really difficult. Again, I live in the middle of farmland. I'm surrounded by dairy and chickens and pigs, all sorts of animals, but to know where to buy the produce butchered and ready or cropped and ready, it was really difficult.
Have local producers taken this on? Have they agreed to your idea? Because, I mean, running a farm in itself is more than a full-time job. It's extraordinarily hard work.
Absolutely. And it's one of the design goals was that it was going to be no work for food producers to reap the benefits of communities building around their products. It can be entirely consumer-led. So if you visit a nice farm, you find some free-range eggs that you want to share with your friends, you can just blip it and that locates the farm. The producer has to do nothing. The photograph's taken. They can just sit back and know that people are talking about them if they like. If they would want to get involved, they can claim their location and input a phone number, email and a website. And all of this is free. Once they've claimed their location, they can blip what's fresh from it daily, and that goes to anyone local to them.
What kind of information are you getting out of this? I mean, I know that I've spoken to you anecdotally about things like buying eggs, and it's something that I don't realise. I mean, I live in the city, and therefore I pick up food here and there, and I'm not too careful about it. That's my admission.
No, for
but,
sure.
I certainly didn't understand that there may be somebody somewhere who has a surplus of eggs or a surplus of milk, and it would be fresh on the day. That sounds wonderful.
We've already had a great check-in, actually, with just the kind of person, you know, an extreme, really, of producer, which is a very small-scale producer with an allotment who sells his fruit and veg for charity on the side of the street by his house. I breed free-range chickens, and I've got a huge surplus of eggs. I've no intention of making a profit out of them. I've got an honesty box outside of my house, and I want to be able to blip the location. So anyone who's going for a walk in the countryside can divert, pick up a load of eggs and be happy.
And is there a place online that we can read some more?
We're at Love Fresh, a dot before the SH.
Mark Spofford there with Love Fresh.
Across the UK.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Up all night with Rod Sharp.
Now, a friendly outrider who we last caught before he live-streamed his climb up Mount Fuji is up to some physical extremes again. Joseph Tame is a digital media producer in Japan. He's warming up to run the Tokyo Marathon, more than enough of a challenge for most of us. But being Joseph Tame, he's decided to take us all with him on the journey. Here he is explaining how.
We have the Tokyo Marathon coming up at the end of this month, and it's totally oversubscribed. You have something like a 1 in 10 chance of getting in. I was very fortunate to get in to run the full 42 kilometres, so I thought I would share the experience with the whole world, courtesy of everyday technology and social media.
Now, you say everyday technology, but you are in fact running around with 5 different Apple products kind of strapped to yourself. How are you doing this? What's your setup like?
Yes, I must admit I am a bit of an Apple addict. So I have 4 iPhones, 2 iPhone 4s and 2 iPhone 3GSs. And they are attached to this very special machine I have made, which I call the iRun. And basically, it's constructed of these 2 shoulder mounts, which are for cameramen, really. And I bought them here in Japan. I took them to the UK at Christmas and went to B&Q and bought a whole load of rods and wires and bolts. And then together with my dad in the greenhouse, we managed to transform these things into this rig, which I can kind of lower down over my head so it doesn't fall off when I'm running. So basically, I've got 4 screens in front of me. One of my favourite parts of this rig, apart from the 4 iPhones and the iPad, is the satellite dish. It's one of the latest models of satellite dishes, otherwise known as a bird feeder, which cost about $2.99. But fantastic connectivity to the 3G network.
You're saying that it's easy enough to put together with everyday items. Are you having to apply coding ingenuity or other know-how to actually get this to work, though? Because I'm fairly sure even if you handed me several phones, I'm not entirely sure how I'd hook it all up together to make something cohesive.
I tell you what, we're incredibly lucky in that we have some very talented people around. And also in the last 6 months, we've seen apps for iPhones and Android really come on. So just a brief summary of the functionality that we have. We have live video, which we'll be using Ustream for. We will have Twitter. We'll have Skype. I will be carrying a mini weather station. It's this tiny little sensor that fits in your hand, and it will detect CO2, noise, humidity, and temperature. And so it connects to an Android handset via Bluetooth, And then that Android handset transmits it live to the internet to a special website, which was designed by some researchers here in Tokyo who were carrying out this kind of environmental monitoring project. Also, I will be using an application on the iPhone called RunKeeper, and that provides a live feed of my GPS location, speed, and just since this week, I've been able to upload my heart rate as well. So I have a heart monitor connected to the iPhone via an ANT Plus sensor, and all that data fed to the net, displayed on a website that I'm creating. So apart from the weather station stuff, to be honest, you know, you can get these things off the shelf. You can get the apps from the iTunes store. And it's just a case of figuring out how to get that all on one page so it all makes sense.
Is it taking a lot to try and make sure that the presentation of live information like that is actually going to work or work smoothly?
Well, this is a real key thing, because last year we tried this on a much smaller scale, and it was a real struggle to try and get, like, you know, these smooth transitions between different video feeds and things like that. So we're currently experimenting with what's going to be easiest. What software do we want to use for the live stream? You know, am I going to use Skype or am I going to use FaceTime to broadcast my signal, my video feed to our studio? Or should I just use Ustream and then we bring that in? I must admit, it's a real challenge. These applications aren't meant to be used in a really complex way. So we're really pushing them to the limit.
So if we want to tune in live when this is happening, when and where should we go?
In Japan, it's going to be Sunday the 27th of February from 8 a.m. That means in the UK, it will be Saturday the 26th of February, starting at about 11 p.m. The place to go, www.tm2011.com. That's TM for Tokyo Marathon. 2011.com.
Joseph, we think you're a bit mad, but we love what you do as an outrider. It'll be fun to watch and see how the marathon goes. After all, it's very unlikely that I'd be trying that myself anytime soon. Changing the topic somewhat now, with the original outrider, Chris Valance, the web carries a lot of fan fiction. Much of it is new stories that are set in the imaginary worlds created by established writers. But what about using Twitter to enable the collaborative creation of an entirely new fictional world? The process sort of explains the City of Urm, an imaginary metropolis built from the tweets of many different writers. It's the brainchild of author Nick Harkaway, and Chris went to find out more.
Well, we're in central London, we're at Bush House, the rather grand headquarters of the World Service. I'm here with author Nick Harkaway.
Hello.
Well, Bush House has all sorts of lines, connections, conduits to various parts of the world. What many people have suspected, but few have known, is that it also has conduits and lines to alternate worlds. Me and Nick are going to go to Studio E9, which doubles as a gateway to the City of Urm. So, Urm is before us. What kind of place is Urm?
The City of Urm is a sprawling maze, a great network, a webwork of streets. There's a half-built dome, arches over one side. There are towers and obviously a vast number of people. It feels somewhere between a sort of gaslight Victorian London and a rather more ancient city, somewhere like Babylon. It's a vast mixture of stories, people, interactions, connections, and secrets. Lots of secrets.
Seen from the water, Urm is vast and jagged, her skyline ruled by the twisting triple fingers of the Tower of Pike and Scale.
It's quite a dark place.
I think it is very dark. I think it's physically dark, and we know that it's lit bioluminescently and by various other means. It's also dark in the sense that the things that take place there seem to be quite gothic and quite alarming in some cases, although there's also a sort of strangely lyrical feeling about it and an optimistic feeling from time to time.
The black heart of Urm is congested. Heat coats everything like varnish. knackered nags slope in their traces as crowds ooze by.
It's a city that doesn't exist in reality. It's a city that's been created by many minds on Twitter.
Yes, I had a rush of blood to the feet one morning, and I'd sort of had this stewing in my head, and I just thought, right, okay. And so I wrote, from the city of Urm, which is imaginary, there arose in that year a great stink. And that was the first Urm tweet. And I invited people to play and to join in and to tell stories about Urm. And they have done in the most extraordinary way, with an enthusiasm which is almost terrifying.
Two cloaked figures huddle in the corner of the Shard, a wine sink in Asp Alley, whispering in a foreign tongue. In the crawfish stench before dawn, Gold Harmon, the lamp dowser, hesitates, then spares the flame at Cuttleside. He smiles.
To participate, all you do is submit a tweet with the hashtag #ermcollab on it. We should say Urm is spelt with a U. It's very open, and yet it seems to be, as you suggested, self-organising.
The Twitter setup gives you the advantage that everything is 140 characters at a maximum. You can write one very, very fast. You don't have to try to produce an ongoing storyline. You can simply offer, like a single flash of a strobe, an image of the city of Urm. It doesn't have to be a string of continuing narrative. It's more like driving, when you drive out of London to the west on the A40, you drive on that high raised section and you're seeing in through the windows of all those houses and tower blocks and so on, and they're usually lit by television screens in the evening time, and this extraordinary blue glow, and you see tiny split second images of people's lives as you do it, and this is the same thing.
In the tallest room of the highest tower rests the cup of bees. To peer into its clammy cell is to die the honeyed death.
Well, we've travelled to Urm via the mysterious tubes of the World Service. If other people want to travel to Urm, how do they do it? What should they bring?
The only thing you need to bring is yourself. And you need not have any fears about, oh goodness, am I going to be good enough at this? The only thing is to think of something that makes you smile or makes you shiver and put it down, and don't fret too much about doing it. There was a project a few years ago called Terramac, where they built a functioning computer out of broken chips, and they designed the architecture of the whole thing, the software and so on, to function with the fact that part of it would be broken all the time, and to work around its own flaws. And the city of Urm, I think, definitely can do that. So the only thing you have to do is get a Twitter account and familiarise yourself with how you use a hashtag, which is one of the simplest things that you can do on the internet, and get going and come and join the fun, and don't feel that there's anything which is impossible, or because it's all text. It's like radio. It has absolutely, you can have as many elephants as you want.
Thanks to Chris there. Let's hope that they don't get too lost travelling around Urm. Well, that is all we can squeeze in again, and it feels like a very busy week indeed, but lots of fun. Of course, if you want to join in or let me know if you're up to something web-related, then I bet you know what to do. Drop a line to me at outriders@bbc.co.uk. Tweet at us on Twitter, where we are BBC_Outriders, or join the Facebook group for weekly updates by searching for Outriders.